One thing that's already impressed itself upon me is that too many people still do not understand the political setup in Judea as it was under the Romans. And I mentioned when I gave it, and that's why I went into great depth in giving it, that it is vital that you understand it down to practically the dotting of the I's and the crossing of the T's. Because to the degree you do not understand it, you are going to miss important points about the arrest and the trial of Jesus, things that cannot be understood just from the face of the text alone, that you must know the background. Otherwise, you really miss a lot of the significance of what is going on. And even when some things are after the thought, obvious in the text, they're not obvious in the text until you have the background firmly in your mind. Otherwise, your eye just reads over certain things and it just doesn't click, doesn't register as far as what is going on. So before we get to that particular topic, be sure that you are extremely well informed about that particular matter. Okay, let me distribute these attendance rosters. I also have a chart which will explain identify and give maybe a partial explanation of the different major groupings that existed in the political and religious firmament in which Jesus operated. And we need to begin to become familiar with what these are. So we allow a few minutes for those to be distributed. I think what we'll do is begin with the political groups that were active in the times of Jesus, because they're easier to discuss and isolate, and then we can spend the bulk of the time dealing with the various religious groupings. In the political spectrum, of course, the majority of the people were probably in the middle. They didn't have any particular strong identification with either of the two political groups that are mentioned. They might have had more sympathy with one than the other, but they were not necessarily actively involved in either group. On the one hand, we have the Zealots, and this is what they were called. Although Josephus, because we have to remember when he writes his works, he is writing under the patronage of the Roman imperial family. He has to sort of soft-pedal certain issues. He doesn't call them zealots, he calls them sicarii. And the term sicarii comes from the term for a certain kind of dagger, which was commonly used in assassinations of leading Jewish officials, which sometimes the more violent wing of the zealots would resort to. And obviously he is painting them in a very negative light. Not that all their activities would necessarily be admirable, even from a patriotic point of view. For example, needing various funds to support those who were engaged in this kind of activity, they were not adverse to extorting money from wealthy Jews, you know, as they would say, not for themselves, but for the cause. And so I guess we can see them partly as robbers or bandits. The term sicarii is used by Josephus to describe these zealots. There's also a euphemistic term which is used in the Gospels to describe them also, that we need to lock in on. And that is, they were called robbers. Now, the reason they were referred to as robbers, as I said, because of this habit of extorting money from the rich, you know, supposedly on behalf of the cause. And that's why, as we get into the gospel text itself, as we get into the matter of the trial and the arrest, the trial, and the death of Jesus, you need to keep in mind that the term robber does not necessarily just mean thief. or in contrawise the term thief, which is just a synonym in one of the Gospels at least, does not necessarily mean thief. That it can be the euphemistic term for this group that Josephus calls the Sicarii, and which are more generally known as the Zealots, those who advocated violent overthrow of the Roman government in order to establish independent Jewish rule. Eventually, this particular party is the one that precipitated the rebellion against Rome that began in 66 AD and culminated in 70 AD with the destruction of Jerusalem, including the destruction of the temple. So this is the group that we are talking about. At least one of Jesus's followers, prominent followers, came from this group. Who is it? Don? No. Not that we have aware of, anyway. Simon. He's called Simon Zelotes, which is not his last name, and it's not the place he was from, which is common in naming things. For instance, Mary Magdalene. Magdalene was not her last name. What is Magdalene? Interesting. Mike? Yeah. It's like saying New Yorker or Carolinian or Virginian or Iowan or Australian or Kiwi or whatever. I had to throw that in. I remembered you were in the class. Didn't want you to feel left out if I mentioned the Australians, you know. So Magdalene simply means somebody from Migdal, the town of Migdal, which is along the shores of the Sea of Galilee. So that's a very common way a last name appears in the scripture. But Zelotes means just somebody who was a zealot, who belonged to this particular party before, of course, he was... had his minds open to, you know, God working with him, and he began to become a follower of Jesus. Now, the other major group, probably smaller in numbers, and certainly smaller in terms of the numbers of people in the general population who would have sympathized with their position, were the Herodians. Remember that you had two prominent members, sons of Herod, that was still around with governmental responsibilities. There was Philip, whose capital was at Caesarea Philippi, as it is mentioned in the Gospels, and who ruled a fairly extensive independent kingdom. And then there was Herod Antipas, who ruled in Galilee. Now, there were, among the, especially the wealthy, some who hoped that the Romans would give one of these two men control over all of Judea, that the Romans would relinquish their control over Judea and hand it over to Herod Antipas or to Herod Philip and let them rule the way Herod the Great had ruled. And, of course, they hoped to gain a lot from this because you might say they were partly sycophants at the court of one of these two men and partly maybe just hoping to get in on a good thing if they gained this independence, because there would obviously be the need for various officials and high-ranking bureaucrats, and they hoped to fill some of those positions. So there was some sort of hope that if the Romans became satisfied with the competence of Herod Antipas and the competence of Philip, that they would qualify for an expanded role. Indeed, this eventually led to Herod Antipas's downfall. The last thing you know about Herod Antipas is that he allows himself to be inveigled by his stepdaughter into having John the Baptist executed. And I think that's... I'm sorry, we have one more mention of him, yes. In connection with the arrest and trial of Jesus, he has a brief role to play there. But, you see, the Romans did give an advancement to his brother. Herod Philip, who is also a tetrarch, as was Herod Antipas, eventually was allowed to call himself king in his area. And Herod Antipas's ever ambitious wife, Herodias, wonder where that name came from, kept pushing him, egging him on to ask the Romans for similar preferment. And the Romans just didn't take too kindly to it, and after he bungled a small matter up there in Galilee again, which was always a very fractious, rebellious sort of place, they packed him off to southern France in exile. At least to his wife's credit, she went and shared his exile with him. She didn't have to, but she did. She accepted her responsibility for what happened. And so she followed after him. But there was this real hope that this might happen. And in fact, we should see in Herod Antipas' execution of John the Baptist, not just personal vendetta, you might say, but his original imprisonment of the Baptist was, of course, in line with his concern that he was a disturbing influence, you see. And therefore, it would attract the attention of the Romans in a very negative way, and they would blame him, why have you let this man wander around free, attracting such a large following, and have done nothing, to suppress him. And so he had sort of put him on ice, hoping to cool his following off, when, of course, he was inveigled into having him executed. Okay, that pretty much takes care of the major political groupings that we must deal with in terms of what pops up in the gospel accounts. Now we have to deal with the much more complicated situation in terms of the religious groupings. Something you should keep in mind is that the vast majority of the people belong to this group rather than any of the ones on the sheet. The Amei Haaretz. I don't know if we have any Hebrew students. We have at least one that I know of in the class. Perhaps if I wrote it, it might help. Does that help any of our Hebrew students translate it? Just curious. Amei is the construct form from the word Am. So what is it? People of the land. Very good. It was not just a dictionary definition meaning those people who lived in the land, because obviously everybody did. Why is it that this group are called people of the land? It is a derogatory term, a derisive term used especially by the Pharisees, and especially one particular wing of the Pharisees, which we will discuss a little later. And it referred to the vast majority of the people who either were not tithe payers or were very casual in the way they tithed, and who were very casual in the way they observed various aspects of ritual purity. In other words, they've been exposed to and taught what at least the teachers said is what God requires of you to be a faithful follower of His. And their attitude was, well, it's too much. If that's what God requires, I guess I'm just going to be not in His good graces, but it's too much. I'm not interested. You could also classify in this group people who were just generally turned off to religion. They were turned off to religion, not in least because some of the people that said, you know, this is the way you're supposed to live, then they observed them living differently. And so they said, these are a bunch of hypocrites anyway, so who wants to even attempt to be like them? You know, they were offended by the hypocrisy they saw by religious leaders. And so this is the vast group of the population, not too much different than the vast group of the population, let's say in the United States or even more so in England today. Those who don't belong, you know, except nominally to any church, and may try to think of themselves as good people because they try to live in a good way based on their understanding of good and evil and righteousness and the opposite and sin, but they're not really involved in the religious scene. But maybe once a year they darken the doors of a religious house of worship, but that's about it. Many not even that. So this would describe the vast majority of the people. Now what we're going to talk about are the different groups to which the minority belong. They may have been the minority, but they were highly vocal and very visible. Let's start with the least important, and I'm using the position of left to right in the sense that we conventionally think of things today. leftist, rightist. The more right you are, the more conservative you are, the more left you are, the more liberal you are. I'm curious, how many of you know why we view things that way? Is it because there's nothing intrinsic in being conservative that makes you rightist, and there's nothing intrinsic in being liberal that makes you leftist? The rest of you don't know. Well, you shouldn't pass out of Ambassador College without at least knowing this. So pardon the digression. It has to do with revolutionary France. After the French Revolution, they established a chamber, a legislature, called the National Assembly. And this was the speaker's rostrum. As it happened, purely by accident, the most conservative groups sat on the right of the speaker, and the most liberal groups sat on the left of the speaker. And that's where we get our term that the liberals or radicals are leftists and conservatives are rightists. That's exactly its origin. Okay, starting with the extreme right then, we have the Essenes and other kindred groups. Now, for instance, many of you are familiar with Qumran as a place name and the fact that the Dead Sea Scrolls were found there. Generally, we say that that was an Essene community. But that's a guess. We're not 100% sure that is an Essene community. Because based on what we know of that group that lived at Qumran, and what we know of the Essenes from the brief mentions in Josephus, and Philo, who was a Jewish philosopher who lived in Alexandria at the same time, they seem to fit the general description of the Essene group. Now, as you can see, I briefly defined what their major thrust was, and that is they rejected the religious establishment and withdrew to the desert. This withdrawal to the desert began in the days of John Hyrcanus. You may recall that when we covered this particular period of time, it was mentioned that the Pharisees, those who were the experts on the oral and written laws, were very upset at the Hellenizing trends that were taking place in social and economic and especially political life. They were very concerned it would spill over into the religion. Now, there were a group of people that were even more concerned and felt that the high priesthood in the person of John Hyrcanus had become totally corrupt, and therefore not wanting to have anything to do with it and be tainted by its evil, they withdrew into the desert. And apparently the community at Qumran was founded at this time, during this period. And they rejected everything in Jerusalem as being impure, including the temple, as being hopelessly polluted. And they felt that they were the only ones who were still righteous, the only true Jews left. And that, like many people in their day, were looking for, of course, the promises of the Messiah, believed that when he came, he would recognize them as being the true faithful, and only they would be qualified to inherit the rewards of the world to come. And everybody else was going to be written off. As I can say, a very extremist group. They withdrew to the desert literally to avoid ritual pollution from the general population, because obviously not many other people would be coming out to have contact with them. Now, they don't enter into the gospel accounts directly. They are sort of on the fringes of the religious establishment, but they are a factor in the religious configuration, which we should be aware of. Now, some people have wanted to connect John the Baptist with them. Can you understand why? Why? Wendy? Yeah. And he ate locusts and wild honey, and he wore this rough garment, sort of renouncing even the normal pleasures or even, let's say, the normal mode of dress, you see. So they're tending to read into that. Oh, he must have been one of the Essenes, you see, and probably got a lot of his ideas from them. There's another reason why they tend to connect John the Baptist with the Essenes. John the Baptist. What was the main thrust of his ministry, his work, his mission, his commission? Yes. Yeah. See, baptism was not something totally new that John devised. In other words, when people came to watch him, they said, what is he doing with those people? What is he dunking them for? I don't understand this. This is strange, weird. No, that wasn't their reaction. That was an accustomed Jewish rite, especially for converts. Converts to Judaism, even today, are baptized. But they don't call it that. They use the word ritual immersion. Because it goes back to the idea that a Gentile, because of the mode of life in which they lived, was ritually impure. And when they be converted, they had to symbolically wash away this ritual impurity, which it's only symbolically it's being washed away, because the ritual impurity is taken away by them beginning to live by God's law, by beginning to observe the laws of clean and unclean foods, and doing everything else, you see, that God's law provides. So that's what makes them ritually pure. But symbolically, to show the change in lifestyle, the change in direction, they washed away the ritual impurity by ritual immersion. And even today, that is still practiced. Now, the Essenes were not only very big on this kind of ritual immersion, which they did on a repeated basis. We don't fully understand why they did it repeatedly. That was not the usual thing. But they also did other kinds of ritual ablutions that normally would only be required of priests in order to be in this extra holy state. And since John the Baptist is the one who begins to use this as a symbol of people changing their minds and attitudes, preparing their minds and attitudes to receive the Messiah when he announces himself, they naturally linked him up with these Essenes who placed similar stress on ritual immersion. But again, similarity does not prove anything. Just because they were doing these things does not prove that John the Baptist was one of them. And from what we know of their teachings, certainly John the Baptist did not follow their most outstanding teachings. And so there's really no reason to jump on the bandwagon and associate John the Baptist with them. But you can understand why, as I say, scholars today sometimes want to put him in that group, and why people understood what he was doing. They understood what he was attempting to do with them and for them. Okay, let's move on to the next group, which is again a group which is fairly easy to isolate and to describe. And that would be the Sadducees. The Sadducees, the majority of Sadducees, almost without exception, were priests and wealthy secular people. Now you might say, well, why are the wealthy secular people allied to the priests in the same religious grouping? Well, because they've been allied together for a long time. When you go back to the government of Simon and John Hyrcanus, remember they had the small Sanhedrin, the Synedrion, which was the day-to-day administrative council running the government, and the natural allies of the administratively talented priests were the administratively talented secular people, who were the wealthy, because of their business and other responsibilities, they had acquired administrative know-how. And so they tended to be fairly close allies, even on the point of view of religion. Now, their approach to the law was, as you see here on the chart, the rigid application of the law as it appears in the Torah. Now, I don't want you to misunderstand something which is commonly misunderstood by most students in the college and many people in the church as well. They did not reject the oral law. But their attitude to the oral law is, it is interesting and offers valuable insights, but the oral law is not binding in the way the written law is. You can accept those insights the oral law provides or not, but the written law is what must be followed. Now, this is probably one of the three of the three major distinctions between the Sadducees and the Pharisees that the scriptures mention, which is also mentioned by Josephus in describing these groups. This is the clearest cut. is that they believe that essentially the written law should be applied exactly as appears in the scripture, good, bad, or indifferent. And that you might look at the oral law, but you're under no obligation to use the insights of the oral law. Now, why do they have this particular point of view? It just gets back to being a power struggle. Who were the experts on the oral law? Right. Remember that beginning with the time of Ezra, the scribes were priests. And that's what God had originally intended. We looked at scriptures, you know, earlier on that show that God had assigned to the priests the responsibility of knowing not just the written law, but also the oral law. They were supposed to be the experts. And Ezra set up these schools for scribes, which initially enrolled priests. But the problem was, as I mentioned before, this was a long, rigorous course of study. And it yielded nothing in terms of income or social or any other kind of advancement. And so many, many priests, as they began to get more lax in their religious responsibilities, began to say, who wants to bother with all this training? Yet they had to have scribes, and so the teachers went out and recruited laymen who were willing to undertake the burden of the education and make themselves into experts on the oral law and on the written law as well. And so you ended up with rather an interesting situation. You ended up with a group of people who had the responsibility to decide cases based on the law, but without the knowledge of the oral law. And on the other side, you ended up with people without any clear responsibility to decide the cases, but with the expertise of the written and oral law. These, of course, would have been the priests, the first group, those with the responsibility but without the knowledge, the people without the clearly assigned responsibility given to them by God or in His Word, but who had the knowledge to do it. These are the people who are the scribes, who are now, as time goes on, increasingly laymen, until finally it's almost totally laymen. I never became totally, but it, you know, came pretty close. The priests had to rely, therefore, on these laymen scribes for information that they did not know. And this produced, of course, resentment and tension between these two groups. Therefore, the priests reacted to this tension, especially when they began to disagree on, you know, the general direction of government policy, as they did in the beginning of the time of John Hyrcanus. The priests, being Sadducean in orientation, saw nothing wrong with what was going on with government policy. Increasingly, the scribes, we can call them now Pharisees, begin to see a lot wrong with life. And the tension just increases between these two groups. So the Sadducees begin to say, well, look, anybody can look in the book and see what the law says. We don't need those scribes. We will just make the decisions according to the way it's written. And we will not give a whole lot of hoot for the oral law. And so they began to move more and more in that direction. And so they tended to have this very rigid approach, which of course tended to offend people who felt they had special circumstances that needed to be taken into account. Now, if you're going before a judge who says, I will not consider any special circumstances, here's your situation, here's the law as it appears in the Torah, this is my judgment, and you have contact with other religious teachers who say, oh, he shouldn't have done that, he should have weighed this aspect of the oral law in terms of your circumstances, he should have done this in your case, naturally you can see the sympathies of the people are going to be towards the leaders who take their special needs and circumstances into account, and not with those who are so rigid. And so that's why generally the majority of the even unchurched people, so to speak, tended to be oriented more towards the Pharisees. Another reason why most of the people tended to be more oriented towards the Pharisees is that they were the ones, of course, who ran the synagogues. Because they were the ones who could read the text. They were the ones who could expound the text, you see, in the synagogue readings. And so therefore, they were the ones who most people tended to regard as being the true guardians of the religious faith. Another reason why the majority of the population tended to be more oriented towards the Pharisees than the Sadducees is that the Sadducees, because of their positions in business and government, were more intimately linked up with the Roman administration. The Pharisees' role, sitting only in the Sanhedrin, the great Sanhedrin that served as sort of a supreme court for legal cases, their involvement was much less with the Roman administration. And so people tended to resent the Sadducees as sort of being quislings or collaborators or whatever other term you might want to dredge up. Catanes, Vichyites, whatever other terms you might like to adduce from 20th century. That brings us now to the Pharisees. The term Pharisee, as it appears in the Gospels, is rather useless. It is rather useless because it tells us little about what that particular individual or group that is pictured in the Gospels of that moment believes in or practices. It's just like using the term Protestant. Oh, it tells you certain things, but Protestant covers everything from high church Anglicans to holy rollers. And I would agree that, I think you'd agree there's a big difference between those Pentecostals on the one side and high church Anglicans who are almost inseparable, at least by liturgy and form of worship, from Catholics, you see. But they're all Protestants, though the Anglicans don't like to usually be called that. Anglo-Catholic. The Pharisees were a similar broad spectrum of groups. There were two major schools among the Pharisees that are worthy of mention because of their importance and also because of the size of their following. They are listed here on the chart as the school of Hillel and the school of Shammai, named after the two most important religious teachers of the Pharisees that lived in the period just before Jesus. I think both men died shortly after Jesus' birth, but before his actual ministry began. Of the two schools, the school of Hillel was much more liberal in its approach and interpretation of the law. Now, both of them were engaged in the same work, devising new applications of the law in response to new conditions, which, if we use a New Testament phrase, is binding and loosing. Something that we have to appreciate is that when Christ said to his disciples, his apostles, that he was committing to them the power to bind and loose, this was not something new that had never been done before. This is what the Pharisees had been doing for hundreds of years, deciding what should be bound and what should be loosed based on new conditions or the individual unique circumstances of given cases. In other words, using the oral law as a guide to interpreting the written law and applying it to new situations that were not specifically addressed. In the same way as Deuteronomy 17 provides, that if a case arises that is too hard for you, you shall go to the Levitical priests and the judge that shall be in that day, and they shall show you the judgment and the sentence in this particular case. This is the situation of binding and loosing. Now, Jesus Christ had no quarrel with the oral law per se. Couldn't very well have had a quarrel with it per se, because most of it was of divine origin. What he did quarrel with is made very clear if you take his words literally. What does he say about these Pharisees that has to do with their practice of binding and loosing? He mentions both, and he criticizes both in terms of the Pharisees. What does he say? Right. In other words, they were telling people, God requires you to do this if you are to be a faithful follower of his. And God had not required that at all. That was a man-made invention, you see, that was unreasonable. But what were they also doing besides binding things that God never intended to be bound, and thereby turning people off to God as in the process? Eric? Yeah, in other words, they knew themselves these were impossible burdens to observe, and they weren't ready to observe them, but that they tried to get the people to do it. And of course, the end result was most people threw up their hands and said, if that's what God wants, forget him. Not interested. That's one reason why Christ was so upset with them. He said, the condition of the country today where most people are turned off to God is your fault. Because you have said, we are the true expounders of religion. We are the true explainers and interpreters of God's will. And then you make people believe that God is a horrible being that wants them to do 1,001 ticky-tacky little things that he's never required. And then you compound the problem by not doing these things yourself, so you make them all turn off by saying, well, it's all a bunch of hypocrisy anyway. You know, remember what Jesus said even to his own disciples. He talked about offending the little ones. He said, better that a millstone was tied around his neck and he was thrown into the sea than he should offend one of these new little ones, you know. Well, these Pharisees were doing that wholesale, turning off whole sections of the population because of their impossible burdens they attempted to bind upon the people. But they also had another problem. What else were they doing that he criticized most severely? Wanda? Right. And he specifically says that they were loosing things that never should have been loosed. So they were erring on both sides because they were working without the guidance of God's Spirit. God was no longer working through them. God had rejected them as the proper teachers of his will. Because rather than being humble and seeking his will, in their vanity of their knowledge, you know, they wanted to proceed on that, and God just said, well, then let them go. Let them make decisions based on their superior knowledge. If they don't need me to inspire them anymore, let them go and do it their way. And they kept getting further and further off the path. And so there was a tendency among the Pharisees to bind things that never should have been bound and loose things that never should have been loosed. Now, we're going to take up some examples of this loosing of things that never should have been loosed and binding things that never should have been bound later. Now, because of this split among the Pharisees, the school of Shammai tended to bind things more than the school of Hillel. They were the ones who were erring on the side of binding too many things that never should have been bound. The school of Hillel was more responsible for loosing things that never should have been loosed. They were each erring in a different direction. Because the responsibility is the same in God's ministry today, and especially when, if necessary, because of lacking knowledge of exactly how to abuse it, it might end up on, let's say, Mr. Takacha's desk. You want to have compassion for the individual in his particular strait, but you can't play loose with the law of God. You can't dispense with it just because you have compassion for the individual. You have to see whether the law allows you to do something for this person in this difficulty, but you can't twist the law to do it. You have to say, is it really in the law? Then you're properly loosing the way God would intend it. And you're not doing it just because of human emotion. Now, we didn't touch upon this when we discussed the oral law last time, early in the semester. I did it privately with some conversation with some people who came up afterwards. That is that binding and loosing in oral law and the making of oral law are still alive and well in God's church. God's church is run not just by the written word of God. It is run also by oral law, which is constantly being increased. Can you name one thing which is a feature of the way God's law is administered in the church which has nothing, it does not come out of the written and comes out of the oral? Mike? Right? These are not clearly enunciated prohibitions. This is a matter of oral law. It's a matter of something being bound. And Christ gave his apostles and their successors the responsibility to bind things that needed to be bound. And with the admonition, of course, and obviously they had to be very careful what they did. What else is a matter of binding? That is a matter of oral law, not the written law. Dan? Right. That's simply a matter of church government decision, that we have this form of a religious service rather than some other form. Or that we choose to stand during opening prayer rather than kneeling. This is a matter of, you know, the church's legislation, some others. Kathy? Right. Because, you know, there have been areas of the world which various adjustments in that have been made. And sometimes adjustments have been made in terms of individual circumstances, too. It's a matter of the loosing, you see, inherent in the law. Because sometimes we've had the situation of saying X is supposed to pay third tithe. If they do so, given their circumstances, they become eligible to receive third tithe. Should they do it then? Well, obviously you have to make a decision. Do they pay it in one hand and take it back from the other? And is that what God would intend? And or is it better to say, well, then just don't pay it, you see, given this circumstance? And there have been other areas in dealing with third tithe administration come under this loosing power, which God has committed to his church. Tithe of the tithe. It's a very reasonable binding based on the principle that we're supposed to use second tithe to keep the feast. But there are certain expenses that those that organize the feast must incur, so we have a meeting hall and other facilities and so on, in which everybody can therefore meet. Now, how should that be apportioned? Well, very reasonable to apportion it using God's tithing principle, that everybody pay a tithe of their tithe, and that way nobody is excessively burdened, you know, in this regard. We have a number of these areas where, or just even the matter of the way we collect holy day offerings. That we collect it on each holy day. That's a matter of binding and loosing. But just as when Nehemiah and his associates bound themselves to pay a third of a shekel for the service of the tabernacle, that became binding. That wasn't optional that somebody in the community could say, oh, I don't like that, I won't do it. It became binding because Nehemiah and his associates had the authority to do it. In the same way, these things, once they're done in the church, as long as it is within the area that God has assigned for binding and loosing, they are binding on the church. They're not optional. They're required if one is to view themselves as being properly responsive to God's government and therefore to God. Now, the last group, which I'll cover very quickly, the table fellowship. They're not an official school like the school of Hillel or the school of Shammai. Most of them, if they sympathized with a school at all, would have sympathized with the school of Shammai, because they, as you can see, are very conservatives. It's not so much their teachings or doctrines that made them a separate group, or their approach to the oral law. It was in addition to those things, they placed a sort of unique, special emphasis upon ritual purity and the traditions of the elders. Now, they're called table fellowship. fellowship groups. Because in their desire to identify with the temple and the sacrifices offered in the temple by the priests, they attempted to duplicate in their home the same degree of ritual purity, regarding their table as the altar. And just as a priest does not approach the altar without going through ritual washings, they did not approach the dinner table without going through ritual washings. That just as the vessels used in the actual service are ritually washed, so too they ritually washed cups and bowls and plates and so on. That just as God legislated, no one who is ritually unclean may approach to my altar. Since they made their table the equivalent of the altar, no one who is ritually impure could sit at table with them. Now, this is probably locking in on some things you recall from being mentioned in the scripture. And we'll, I think, have a number of instances where we'll be looking at scriptures starting next time, where we see these little incidents coming up where certain people are coming and accusing Jesus, how come you don't do this and how come you don't do that? You can see that this is the group that is involved. These are the ones that made a much to-do about it, about these kinds of things. Okay, we'll let you go and we'll pick up on this next time.